Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about a terrific podcast called Time to Eat the Dogs. It's hosted by Michael Robinson, a historian, and it's about exploration. Now, if you're clever, and I know you are because you listen to the New Books Network, you can probably figure out why a podcast about exploration would be called Time to Eat the Dogs. Well, Michael has interviewed many scholars and historians and researchers, and he even interviewed an astronaut about their books about exploration. You can find Time to Eat the Dogs at TimeToEatTheDogs.com. What else? You can also find it on iTunes. As I say, we really love this podcast at the New Books Network, and we love it so much that we're going to republish some of Michael's excellent interviews. And if I would just stop talking, which I'm going to do presently, you'll be able to hear one of those interviews. So I'm going to stop talking.
It's Time to Eat the Dogs, a podcast about science, history, and exploration. I'm Michael Robinson. In 1845, two British naval ships left England with 129 men in search of the Northwest Passage. They were never heard from again. The disappearance of the Franklin expedition shocked the world. Dozens of expeditions set sail into the Arctic looking for the missing explorers. Today, Russell Potter talks about the expedition and the reasons why it continues to fascinate people around the world. Potter is professor of English and Media Studies at Rhode Island College. His book, Finding Franklin, The Untold Story of a 165-Year Search, came out in 2016 with McGill-Queen's University Press. Russell Potter, thank you for speaking with me today.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
I was wondering if you could tell us who was John Franklin and what was the Franklin expedition trying to do?
Well, it's one of my great missions in life, actually, to get people in the United States to think of someone other than Benjamin Franklin. But he was an Arctic explorer, a veteran in his day. I guess you'd think of him along the lines of a senior astronaut like John Glenn. One last try for what was at the time the great British quest to transit the Northwest Passage across America. And his last voyage sailed in 1845. He was supplied by the government with two large bomb vessels. These are very big, wide, heavy ex-naval vessels that they thought would be great for going through the ice because they were big and tough and strong. And 129 sailors and officers went with him. Well, 128, actually, because one of those is Franklin himself. And they set sail and actually made fairly good progress their first year, by all accounts. The habit back then was to overwinter in a harbor someplace off the main course because you had to get out of the way of ice floes and grinding ice. And then when things thawed out, the next season you would go off again and continue on your way. The thought was it would take about three such seasons, so his ships were provisioned for 3 years. And they sailed off and were never seen again. It's a perfect romantic tale of disappearance. And eventually the very first of these three harbors at Beachy Island was located, and three graves of early expirations, early casualties. And then over a process of more than 150 years, little bits and pieces places beyond that. But until quite recently, neither of his two ships was located. You'd find a human remains, some brass tacks or a piece of wood, and that sort of stuff. So throughout the Victorian period and on into the modern era, it was one of these persistent mysteries. People tended to get a little obsessed with it. And those who had the means and the proximity would actually go up there and conduct searches of their own. And this continued right on through the modern period, right through the last decade or so, which is the point in time that Parks Canada, the federal agency in Canada, got involved with it.
So you were mentioning that bits and pieces were coming out about Franklin. I'm wondering if you tell us about John Ray and his discovery.
Yeah, well, that was kind of the first breakthrough, really the biggest breakthrough in the 19th century, because Ray, unlike the usual British officers, was on very good terms with the Inuit and followed many of their ways of hunting and traveling. And in fact, in a place where it appears that some of Franklin's men starved to death and resorted to cannibalism, Ray was sledding through and giving extra food to local Inuit because he had more than he could eat. Wow. So it was he in 18. It is a testament to his survival skills there. And of course, he was a Scotsman, not a British fellow. So, you know, he was already part wild from the British point of view. those Scotsmen hunted for food. Perish the thought. Mm. But at any rate, he encountered a group of Inuit in 1854 who were the first real witnesses to what had occurred, led by a fellow named Inuk Pujishuk. And this fellow was wearing on his parka a gold cap band from one of the officers' hats. So Ray let it be known he would pay handsomely for any items of this sort, and ended up coming back with a large cache of personal items and relics, as well as testimony that he was the first to bring back the testimony that cannibalism had occurred. And you know, in Britain, everyone was very happy to receive the relics, and people waited in line to see them. But the news of cannibalism was not quite so warmly received, and Ray ended up being pilloried in the press by Charles Dickens, who was a great fan of his pet Arctic heroes, and who denounced the Eskimos as savages with a domesticity of blood and blubber, and believed, in fact, that he thought the Eskimos had murdered Franklin's men more likely. So Ray had a bit of a tough time on his return. Now we've all of that has been vindicated, of course. We've actually had forensic studies of human remains there that show cut marks consistent with cannibalism. So Ray has now emerged in modern times as a hero of the story, but at the time he was not.
So if John Ray was the first person to really figure out where the Franklin expedition had gone, and also give us information about the fate of at least some of his crew, then what preoccupied so many searchers between that period and the studies of the late 20th century?
Yeah. Well, you know, his evidence was incomplete. I mean, this is the thing. It was oral testimony from the Inuit, and each person had only their own account to offer. And some of the Inuit frankly said, you know, I did not see these things myself. I have only heard of them. So it wasn't until another 5 years after Ray that anybody got to the place that was described. That was Leopold McClintock. And even then, what he found there didn't tell a complete or coherent story. You know, if you're looking at 129 people, where you'd expect 129 human remains, but that's not what he found. It was a few scattered skeletons and abandoned whaleboat, a heap of provisions. One single note was discovered, the so-called Victory Point record, which raised as many questions as it answered. And of course, the ships. The big missing piece of the puzzle was the ships. I mean, they're very large, substantial vessels. Where had they gone? There was no sign of them. Inuit testimony spoke of one that had sunk in shallow water at a place they called Utjulik. But even finding that vessel, and even using the Inuit testimony that had been collected back then, took a long time. It's a very vast area. I think that's the principal reason. You just can't, it's a needle in a very big, wet and frozen haystack.
So in 1984, Owen Beatty, who I believe is an anthropologist, correct?
Yes,
and
that's right.
John Geiger traveled to the Arctic to look at those graves that had been known about for over 100 years on Beachy
yes.
Island. Could you talk a little bit about what they figured out?
Well, it was a dramatic series of events. They actually decided to exhume the three bodies. They did one, John Torrington, in 1984, and the other two in 1986. And they exhumed them. They conducted autopsies. They set up a field tent. They did x-rays. They took tissue samples. I think the biggest impact on the public, though, is that we actually saw the faces of three of Franklin's men. And, you know, at least on the outside, they looked fairly well preserved. Once you looked inside, of course, you found that there was a lot of degradation of the tissues, and they weren't as frozen as they might have been. But I think seeing the faces was a very important thing. John Torrington was voted one of People magazine's most intriguing people of 1984. Not bad for being dead for all that time. And then I think the other thing, of course, was the evidence they collected showed us that, well, A, all three men suffered from tuberculosis, which wasn't a huge surprise, and that there was evidence that at least two of them had fairly high elevated levels of lead. And the tinned food that had been supplied to Franklin in somewhat of a rush order was shown to have very large beads of lead solder. Some of the tins were actually found on the same island as the grave. So I think that was the first, you know, sort of scientific explanation. I mean, it at the time it seemed to explain everything. Now we think, well, it explains some things and not others. But it was a kind of a breakthrough in the case, and it just got people interested. So, a lot of folks who came in later years to continue the search first heard about it in the book that Geiger and Beatty wrote called Frozen in Time.
It's almost like watching a British murder mystery. It's a, you know, a question of like, you know, who did it, in which room, and how did it happen?
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, over the years, as I've read about this, I've seen scurvy, starvation, lead poisoning, botulism. I'm probably missing a few. But what's the thinking now about the probable, you know, cause of death of all these men?
Well, you know, it probably won't be Professor Plum in the conservatory with the candlestick. But I do, you know, the thing with lead is we found out that people in the mid-19th century, just ordinary folks who didn't go on Arctic journeys, had fairly higher baseline levels of lead. So the levels that we saw at Beachy and now in other remains that have been recovered are not alarmingly high in most cases. But some people evidently were suffering from a much worse case of lead poisoning. And one of the mysteries is we don't know quite why so much variability among different individuals. So that takes lead away as an explaining everything thing, but it certainly was still a factor. Scurvy happened on all of the voyages. You know, they sent lemon juice, which they mixed with rum and water and put in barrels. So it lost they didn't understand vitamin C chemically, so it lost its potency over time. And scurvy was a visitor on almost any extended Arctic voyage of that period. And then the other thing that really is the key factor is that they had to leave the ships. You know, the entire plan rested on staying inside the ships where there was food and heat and Fraser patent stoves and things that you could survive on. And when they had to leave the ships, which apparently at the time were stuck in the ice for more than a year, they had to haul their supplies and goods overland in sleds they built on board ship with cast iron runners and heavy oak boards and heavy supplies. And I think exhaustion, just physical exhaustion, not realizing the caloric needs or being able to provide them for huge crews of people hauling sleds, so that by the time they had gotten a short ways from the ship, people were pretty debilitated. And that's kind of when the end began, because they were too sick to get out, too sick to get back. Although now it appears, since we found the ships, that they may have been remanned. There's some evidence suggesting that. So those were all of those things that were sort of racing to see which one would kill off most of the people soonest.
It seems like Franklin has become a kind of symbol of, or the Franklin expedition has become a kind of symbol of Western arrogance in the 19th century. This group of men, the best of the British Navy, with these really high-tech ships going into the Arctic and dying, whereas the so-called primitive Inuit are able to not only survive, but actually assist these men. Do you think that, and I should say I'm guilty of using that narrative a lot in my teaching.
Sure.
Do you think that that's accurate, that this is a kind of cautionary tale, or do we play it up too much?
Well, it is a cautionary tale. I think it's not quite right to single out Franklin as being the most culturally obtuse of all, because he was doing exactly what previous and indeed some successive expeditions had done. They had the same outlook, the same attitude. They took very similar supplies and went on similar sorts of ships. So, you know, in writ large, if you look at the British approach to the passage, I agree, it's true. They weren't particularly interested in learning from indigenous peoples knowledge about anything, except perhaps having them come on board ship and draw a map for them. And then if they didn't like what the map showed, they said, oh, this map can't possibly be right. So it wasn't really a good situation. Whereas someone like John Ray or people who worked for the Hudson's Bay Company, which had been up in the area since the 17th century, they had to live with, work alongside natives. And of course, they had realized that natives had some pretty extraordinary survival skills, having lived in the area mm-hmm. for thousands of years. So I think that narrative is partly true anyway, but mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, I think that Franklin's relations with indigenous folks, insofar as he had direct contact with them and on previous expeditions, he seems to have had a relatively open-minded and not unenlightened view. I don't think he is an individual villain of any sort, and certainly mm-hmm. it is interesting and perhaps slightly ironic that when the ships were finally found, that was almost entirely due to Inuit testimony that had been collected by others who came after Franklin and were searching for him. So that's the other part of the story, that the Inuit actually were the key witnesses in the solution of this murder mystery.
Actually, since you bring it up, can you tell us about the Parks Canada discoveries of Erebus and Terror?
Sure. Yeah, well, just a short bit of backstory on that. So, you know, Parks started their searches in 2008, but other folks had been up there doing the same thing, just not with the resources that Parks had. So a Canadian guy named Dave Woodman was the first to really look at the Inuit evidence, much of which had been collected by an American named Charles Francis Hall and had been gathering dust in the Smithsonian for a century or more. So he went to the original manuscripts and transcribed and collated all of this Inuit evidence, and then he decided to go up there on his own dime, as it were, and try to conduct searches. He had to deal with very limited resources. He didn't have big ships. He couldn't tow around a sonar towfish on a big vessel or anything. Mm-hmm. So he went back and forth. He put a magnetometer on a komituk, which is a sled. He walked over land with teams of people trying to search for artifacts. And he kind of handed passed the baton, I guess you'd say, to Parks in 2008 to a fellow named Robert Grenier, who was at the time of the head of Parks' underwater archaeology team. And Grenier had caught his Franklin fever from Woodman and pretty much based his work on that. And then that was continued every year, I think, except 2009, Parks searched. But they didn't find anything till 2014. So even with the resources they had and the support of a Canadian icebreaker and plenty of equipment and ground support, it still took them a long time to, as they say, mow the lawn back and forth and back and forth, trying to eliminate areas that hadn't already been eliminated by Woodman's work and so forth. So the first was found in 2014. Ironically, this search was called the Victoria Strait Expedition. And they went, mm-hmm. the theory there was, well, maybe the ships didn't get very far from where they were first abandoned. We'll look and see if there's anything there. But they couldn't get there because of the ice conditions that year. So they were forced to go back to the area where Woodman had started looking, this area the Inuit called Utjulik. And it's actually there that they found the first of the ships, which turned out to be HMS Erebus, which was Franklin's flagship. And just as the Inuit had said, it was found in shallow water, shallow enough that the masts would have been above the surface before they were broken off by passing ice. And Parks has been diving on and learning stuff about that ship for the past several years. And so there's an exhibition, actually, that's in Britain right now at the Maritime Museum. It'll be coming to Canada and then actually coming down here to the U.S. to Mystic Seaport. And this contains 22 items brought up from Erebus. Simple things like a shoe, complicated things such as, fragments of marine buttons, fragments of a marine's belt buckle, a tiny little container which may have contained contained either fish paste or hair cream, little tiny tokens of everyday life on the ship, which is quite interesting because until this discovery, we had almost nothing from either vessel. I mean, they both sank pretty thoroughly. There wasn't a lot washed up on shore, and if it were, of course, the Inuit were very keen to repurpose it. A piece of wood was precious up there, so until the first ship was found, we had so little evidence of that kind. And then the second was found 2 years later, which was astonished all of us. We thought, well, one ship, we've been pretty lucky. Don't ask for too much. And then the other turned up, HMS Terror, actually in a small bay that had been named Terror Bay by one of the searchers more than a century before. He had no idea the Terror was in Terror Bay. And that was also found by Inuit accounts, but from a modern living person, Sammy Kogvik, who is a Canadian ranger and resident of the town of Joehaven, who had seen a mast, he thought, sticking out of the water some years previous, and then it disappeared. He directed a vessel there, and lo and behold, there was the ship. So now we have two to deal with.
And have these discoveries changed the thinking about the fate of the Franklin expedition or any of the events of the last 2 years?
I think so, but the ways they're going to do that are as yet uncertain. I mean, they're located. The Terror has certainly had made it through the narrow straits that we thought it might have been crushed in, and the Erebus had made it even further down to the mainland, to the Adelaide Peninsula. You know, by any measure, they had actually passed by the point of the farthest survey from the west, and so in a way, that supports the idea that, as the Victorians said, that Franklin's men forged the last link with their lives, right? Mm. And that gives us a great story there. But we still don't have enough physical evidence to tell whether the ships were actually piloted or might possibly have drifted for all or part of their journey. I think it's less likely that the Terror had drifted because it's in a bay and its ships don't typically drift right into bays. With the Erebus, it's a little trickier. So, you know, they're looking at, you know, whether the anchors were deployed. In one case, we thought an anchor had been deployed from Terra, but it turned out that the cable for the anchor had just played out from the windlass and the anchor was still stowed on board ship. So, you know, a lot of careful work by underwater archaeologists will be needed before we know about that aspect. But, you know, it's reignited the old who discovered the Northwest Passage question, which should always be with us, I'm afraid.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, I remember that these ships were provisioned for a long period of time, potentially overwintering 2, 3, even 4 years. Do you think that if the crew had stayed with the ships, they would have survived for longer, or do you think there was some catastrophic event that forced the men to leave the ships?
Well, I think the first abandonment, and we do have the Victory Point record talks about that to a degree, it gives us a timeline anyway. So you're looking at two seasons when the ice would have been expected to break up or hoped to break up, and it didn't. And the ships were in a less than ideal position. They were out in the pack ice. They were not in a safe harbor. So it might have been physical peril to the ships or simply the thought that, you know, they're stuck, and if we stay aboard them, we'll make too little progress and we'll be here to our deaths. So we must abandon them. And then either the ice broke up in a subsequent season. It's conceivable that the men were on land and said, "Hey, look, there's our ship," and then got back on it. Or it's possible that they returned to the ships after discovering that, in fact, they were not going to make it very well over land either, and made a renewed effort to pilot them through. So we just don't have a good timeline. I guess that's the real question. Mm-hmm. So without a timeline, we can't say. But I, one way or another, I think the break out onto land and the attempt to move men and supplies over land was the real disaster. And if they made it back to the ships, I'm sure they had high hopes. That was probably the right thing to do. But by that time, diminished in numbers and resources, you know, they may simply have not felt they could go on any longer and then re-abandoned them, essentially. That may be the case.
What plans does Parks Canada have for the wrecks?
Oh, well, the resources are amazing. And in fact, the big news just a couple of days ago is that the UK, after bandying about the bush for quite some time, they had already agreed in principle to do this, but they decided to formally give the ships to Canada. So that clears up a lot of issues over control and of the wrecks and so forth. And at the same time, Parks Canada has reached some very good agreements with the local Inuit organizations to share custody and care of the relics that they recover. So all of those tempests and all of those teapots are now over, and Parks seems to have a pretty firm commitment. Originally the Conservative government of Canada with Prime Minister Stephen Harper had put a lot of money into this because Harper believed that somehow these ships would secure Canadian sovereignty over the Northwest Passage, which is a matter of some dispute. But the Trudeau government seems to be equally strong in their support. And in fact, they already have built a small barge as a sort of a diving platform, which was used this summer. And they have next year, they're going to have a former Coast Guard vessel, the David Thompson, which has been in dry dock being renovated and refitted. They're going to have that ship dedicated to their searches. In the past, they'd have to depend on an icebreaker, and icebreakers have many different things that they have to do. So your search season might be cut short because of search and rescue or something. Now they're going to have a dedicated vessel that will be able to anchor near the dive site all season long and provide full support to the searchers. So I think they'll be getting in a lot more dives. I think they will be, they haven't yet reached the point of bringing up much in the way of additional materials, but I think they will soon reach that point. The focus right now is on Erebus because the wreck is in a much more fragile state. But of course, we're all wondering about Terra because that looks, at least from the outside, to be much better preserved. It's deeper water. It's been less damaged by passing ice and such like things. So that's, from the point of view of the historian, we want Terra. But from the point of view of the archaeologist, I think they're going to do some work on Erebus first.
Now you just got back from the Arctic a couple of months ago, correct?
That's right. Yeah,
I remember when you went up in 2004 when you were working with the PBS series Nova on the Franklin Winter Camp.
That's right.
So what was it like to go back?
Well, it was great to get back. I mean, you realize how much you've forgotten over the course of time. And of course, when I was there with the Nova crew, I was pretty much at their disposal. I had time to go shoot the scene, time to go get pictures of this, get on the plane, get off the plane, get on the helicopter, get off the helicopter. I didn't really have a lot of control over how I spent my time. And this past August, I was up there with two different outfits. The first was One Ocean. They have two vessels up there right now, the Academic Yoffe and the Academic Sergei Vavilov. They're both ex-Soviet research vessels that were built in Finland. They're ice strengthened, and they're great ships. I mean, they really, they're the appropriate kind of ship to go up there in, about 90 or so passengers. And I gave shipboard lectures on board the vessels, and then we were able to do landings at various sites of interest. Of course, you get the permits from the Nunavut government and so on. And you'd land in Zodiacs and actually be able to walk around on the ground at many of these sites. So, of course, Beachy Island. I was actually at Beachy Island three times in August, which was kind of bizarre. And then other sites such as Radstock Bay nearby, which has a lot of Franklin remains. Fury Beach, where one of the earlier ships before Franklin was wrecked. Port Leopold, which is where the first major naval search for Franklin was based. And so you really got to, it's like a living history sort of a thing. So you could walk around and say, hey, look, there's one of the Franklin tin cans. I wonder what evidence that provides. I mean, I'm not an archaeologist, although both the outfits I went with had an archaeologist there on staff. So, you really learn something about the the complex nature of evidence up there. And also you see how much modern evidence is layered. So at Radstock Bay, for instance, beautiful old Franklin tins and barrel staves and barrel hoops, and a board that says something like Joe and Fred 1973 on it. It's like, oh, geez. So you get this sense of multiple use over long periods of time. And of course, lecturing, it's wonderful to lecture on one of these ships because you can say, well, you know, over here in the Simpson Strait, well, actually, we're over here. We're just a short distance away on this map. So it is a sense of immediacy and so forth. And in addition, we visited several Inuit communities, and including Grease Fjord, which I'd always wanted to get up to. That's the farthest north of all of them. And then my second tour was aboard the ship that must not be named, as we like to say, the Crystal Serenity. I was working for, I know, big, huge cruise ship, all kinds of problems that it might raise. It made it through, and they're not going to do it again, or so they say. But I worked for Arctic Kingdom, which is an expedition group up there that was subcontracted to Crystal Cruises. So they put together a great staff of lecturers. We had Ken Harper, who's a historian of the Inuit people who lived up there himself for many years. We had Pita Inuk, who's the first commissioner of Nunavut and an Inuit history expert. We had just fabulous folks.
So how does this story play out in Nunavut? Is it received the same way that we receive it down here or in Toronto or Montreal, or does it have a different flavor to it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I my experience up there, and this is the first time I've been in so many different communities, really, and it was great to be up there with Ken Harper at many of these because he speaks Inuktitut. And the feeling I got from most of the folks we met was they were pretty excited about it. I mean, they were excited about it because it was a history story that they found as interesting as anyone else did in many ways. They were excited about it because Inuit played such a key role in the discoveries. So talking about the expedition was talking about the contribution of Inuit to the solution of the mystery. And of course, they're hoping for and looking for economic benefits. So for instance, most recently this year, Parks Canada, they have an advisory committee of Inuit that tells them, you know, here's what you might do to work with us on various things. And they decided to hire guardians, as they call them, for each of the ship sites. And these would be Inuit hunters, most of them from local areas, who would spend, you know, most of the season when the ships are accessible, they're guarding them and looking out for them and be paid by the federal government. And that really, that was a breakthrough. I think a lot of Inuit said, well, okay, you're actually going to hire us to help you with what you're doing, and you're going to hire a number of us on a regular basis. That's sparked a lot of hope and changed the conversation up there, as they say.
When I think about the Franklin search, it seems like it goes through all of these different phases. In fact, you write about these different phases in your book, Finding Franklin. It's very clear at the beginning of the search, when people thought that Franklin and his men were alive, why there would be such interest in the Arctic and the story. And then later on, when it becomes clear that they've died, it seems to take on a life of its own, a different kind of incarnation. What do you think is going on? And do you think that the recent Parks Canada discovery of the ships will change that?
Well, it is. There have been many Franklins. I think it was Margaret Atwood who first said, you know, for every historical era, there's a different one. There's, you know, Franklin the hero, Franklin the mystic, Franklin the idiot. So you start out, of course, it's search and rescue. You're hoping to render effective relief, as the reward poster said. Then that gives way to this sort of kind of mournful, national mourning, really, this sort of national outpouring of grief, and these little fragmentary relics being brought back and put on display and people lining up to see them, and they're like saints relics. I mean, even the use of the word relic is unusual, right? I mean, it's not every expedition that has relics,
right?
Other people just leave garbage on the beach. So you have that, and then I think, you know, over time it's gone through a number of phases since then. I mean, I think in the early 20th century, since most of the searchers were people who are up there working professionally, it was a hobby, I guess, something that they took a passing interest in because they were there and had the opportunity. Then I think after the Beachy Island exhumations and Beatty and Geiger's book, then I think you had more armchair people who thought, you know, here's a mystery, here's an enigma, here's something I can solve, and you know, here's something I can research and maybe contribute to on my own. And that that has continued in this course even more so today with the power of the internet. We have a Facebook group, but we have people who are searching digital archives and so forth. And we've sort of crowdsourced, I guess you'd say, some of the work that in the past you'd have to travel to archives to do.
What's interesting listening to you talk about this is that you clearly wear two hats. You know, you walk between two worlds, one of which is this kind of popular fascination with Franklin and the mystery of Franklin, but then also you're an academic and a person who's very interested in cultural studies. Is it ever tough to kind of unify those two things together, or is it okay?
Well, it depends. I mean, in terms of when I speak, whether it's on board a ship or at a local historical society or what have you, my audience usually comes with certain awarenesses. I try not to give an academic talk to a non-academic audience, and I don't think any enthusiasm is ever out of place. If people are interested in this, I want to support and speak to that. I guess where the academic part of me comes in though is when I see things being bandied about that I don't think, for which I don't think there's good documentary evidence, or speculations that are just based on, hey, I'm just going to find out five things about this story and then I'll solve it tomorrow. I sometimes have to strike a cautionary note. I have to be the representative for what Keats calls negative capability, the ability of holding contradictory ideas in your head at the same time without resolving it, because I think so much of this is unresolved. And it may stay unresolved. I mean, people come up to me now and they'll say, oh, aren't you excited that we've solved the Franklin mystery? The ships have been found. And I said, we haven't solved the Franklin mystery. It's layers of an onion. That's one good metaphor for it. And, in terms of the finding of the two ships, I say that doesn't bring us closer to a solution. It just means it's a much bigger onion and more layers that we're going to have to sort through. And it's going to take time. The archaeological work is going to take probably at least 10 years to recover what can be recovered, and then those things will have to go into conservation. And if we do find written materials, they'll have to be interpreted and analyzed. And, you got to be in it for the long haul on that regard. But at the same time, I'm happy. It is amateur folks, people without academic training at any rate, have been a big part of the solution of the story. Dave Woodman was just a mm-hmm. regular guy. He worked for BC Ferries, ferrying people back and forth for years, and then taking as much time as he could off to pursue his research. He's not a trained historian, but it turns out that his work was central to solving this. So I like that. I'm happy to be in a field where amateurs and professionals can both contribute something.
I certainly felt that way when I was writing my book, that the people who had done the most work on Arctic exploration with a bit of a different focus than mine, but nevertheless were amateur historians who had poured through the archives with incredible meticulousness to reconstruct a story of an expedition. And I appreciated so much that they did that work. In the end, my questions were a little different from theirs. And sometimes I think that there's an overlap between the amateur and the academic. Sometimes it's easier than other times. I remember you and I were at that conference Philadelphia where, a number of people became completely fixated on the question of who reached the North Pole first and whether anyone did it at all. Anyway, how do you deal with that?
Well, it is tricky. I mean, I think there are these, the equivalent of the North Pole question is the who was the first to discover the Northwest Passage. And, depending on how you define the question, there's a case to be made for Franklin and his ships. There's a case to be made for McClure, who was another explorer who went in on one ship, crossed over land, and then went out on another. Well, okay, you could argue for that. I mean, the obvious answer, of course, is Roald Amundsen, because he's the first one who actually sailed through it, which was the general idea. But you will see partisans. I remember the Cook people at that Philadelphia conference were a bit of a thorn in everyone's side, but perhaps a productive thorn, I guess. I'm used to dealing with a certain amount of partisanship here and there. And of course, then the other folks that I've met are the descendants of people, and that's really interesting. I mean, you would think that descendants of people would be eager to vindicate and lionize their ancestors, but in fact, they're very willing to see their ancestors with warts on. In fact, they're interested in the warts, which kind of compounds expectations. Yeah. So one of the guys I was on one of the ships up north with is a guy named Rick, who is the great, 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 great-grandson of James Reed, who was the ice master on Erebus. And we had some great conversations in the bar lounge on the Vavilov, you know, just going into all of the grisly details. And it turned out that his ancestor's possible skull, they did facial reconstructions on two of the skulls, and one really does look quite a bit like James Reed. You know, so here I am showing this guy's ancestor's skull being reconstructed on the big screen. And, yeah, he said, can I have pictures of that? I don't think I'll show them to my mother, he said, but I'd love to have some pictures.
So what do you think your next project's going to be?
Well, at the moment, I'm actually working on a book that will not be original. Well, it won't be my original writing, but I'm trying to collect all of the letters that were sent to or from, and there are fewer of those, of course, the Franklin Expedition. The last post went out from Greenland, and almost everybody wrote at least a letter or two home, even the semi-literate sailors, whose letters, to my mind, are the most interesting. Huh. So, and then, of course, all the letters that people wrote to them, which, of course, were eventually returned as undeliverable. So that's an interesting project. It brings you back into the archives. You get a real sense of the worldview and daily lives of officers and sailors and their families, and of course in the course of that you meet a lot more descendants, because it's often the descendants that have the letters or have the information on their ancestors. So that's going to be a longer term project. It might take a couple of years to get all the letters properly transcribed and edited and so forth, but and I've got some other folks working on that as a collective project, because every letter has to be read more than once by one set of eyes. So it's exciting, though.
What is interesting about the letters from semi-literate sailors?
Well, you know, for one, they're the masters of the run-on sentence. They're not fond of punctuation, so it just goes on and on. But they're wonderful, and this is the little things they report. There's one guy who complains about the mosquitoes, which are far more venomous than any English bug, and he spells bug B-U-G-G. It's just you get a real sense of personality in the peculiarities of spelling and punctuation, whereas in the officers' letters, also very eloquent, but they're more conventional letters, I guess I'd say, for the most part. So it's nice to have a mixture of the two, and I think it'll be a very interesting document for people who want to get a sense of you know, the sort of lived experience of the people who went and the families who were staying behind, who are a big part of the story too. We don't yet have a census of all the letters. That's our first project, is to locate all known letters, and it keeps growing. This may be a gigantic tome. I don't know what I'm getting into, but it's fun. It's fun work.
You're probably getting pretty good at deciphering really bad handwriting.
Yes,
too.
Well, it's true. And there's one gentleman who we haven't yet fully identified, but the infamous Peglar papers appear to have been written as a series of letters. They have addresses, but they're all written backwards, including the addresses being written backwards. Heaven only knows what the post would do with those, but they're part of the story too. So just to imagine why someone would write backwards and to decipher that, I call it the Dead Sea Scrolls of the North. Gives you an extra feeling of discovery when you've made sense of a single word, really. So I think you get the peculiarities are enlightening, and just even the smudges of ink or the stains on the paper or the fold. We've learned, for instance, how they folded a letter into an envelope, a self-envelope, as they called it, mm-hmm. Which I had known nothing about. But you can actually see the creases on the page where the letter was folded.
One of the things that's so interesting about the Franklin Expedition is exactly what you just described, which is this just the lived experience of being on one of these Arctic ships seems so otherworldly, especially to us now where we're so not only comfortable but so connected to the world.
Yes, yes.
Do you feel that, you know, very viscerally when you read these?
I do. It is interesting too, because being on board a ship and seeing the Arctic from that direction, and also, you know, on the Vavilov at any rate, which I was on for my first 20 days, there's practically no internet. I mean, there's text-based email with attachments up to, I think, 200K or something that sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. There was no way to log onto Facebook or read online newspapers. So I really had no idea what was going on in the outside world for 20 days. That's a short period of time, of course. And I could see only what I could see from the deck of the ship. And that put me in a very similar mind, I think, to the mind of the people who went there with Franklin. I mean, they obviously didn't have great maps and charts and satellites and so on. But you sort of see what it's like to go through, you know, one knot at a time through the passage and to be relatively unaware and even unable to find out much about what's going on outside. You know, I think of the American Greely expedition when they finally got to Cape Sabine and there was some fruit wrapped in newspapers and they were starving. But the first thing they did was read the newspapers.
Russell Potter, thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to share knowledge with someone who has knowledge.
That's our show for today. Our theme music was composed by Zabrat. If you want to listen to other episodes of Time to Eat the Dogs, subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a few moments to rate and review it. I'd like to hear what you think. If you have an idea for a guest or you just want to get in touch, email me at timetoeatthedogs, that's one word, lowercase, @gmail.com. You can also find episodes, links, blog posts, and a lot of exploration-related stuff at timetoeatthedogs.com.